Rome and Martyrdom. This study is more in the nature of straight narrative with perhaps less applicatory material. We, however, will be coming more to that in the two concluding lectures. We've divided our study into four sections: the journey to Rome, recorded in Acts 27 and 28, the first Roman imprisonment, the final period of freedom, and his rearrest and martyrdom. First then, the journey to Rome. And I'll follow the practice of earlier and just give a very brief outline of the narrative of these last two chapters of Acts. Paul is entrusted for safekeeping to a Roman centurion named Julius. He is a centurion of the Augustan band or cohort. Right. This was a select group of troops who had courier and escort duties throughout the empire. The Roman Empire, as you know, was extremely wide in its extent, and these were the men who were sent with special messages, special prisoners, accompanying special officials and so on. So it was a group of men who were trained for this work, and it's an evidence of Paul's significance and rank that he was put in the charge of this man, Julius. There were a number of other prisoners, but it seems that Paul was the only prisoner of rank, and under Roman law, he would be allowed to take two attendants, or personal slaves. And it seems from the record that Aristarchus and Luke travelled with him, and they would be entered on the manifest as his personal slaves. The party left Caesarea in the early autumn, hoping to reach Rome, I would think, by late October, because in the winter, sailing became impossible. They started off in a small coasting vessel, and they took the vessel up north, hoping to find a larger ship somewhere along the coast. They went along the coast to the port of Myra. Now, the significance of Myra is, I hope you can, most of you can see the map, is that it is due north of Alexandria, the great corn granary of Rome. And what the ships used to do, the great corn ships, instead of facing the open sea from Alexandria south of Crete to Italy, they would sail at a certain time of year due north to Myra. They would make a landfall there and then proceed from there. So Julius the centurion knew that there was a good possibility of picking up a larger vessel along this coast. And this is in fact what happened, because when the party reached Myra, they there found a large Alexandrian corn ship loaded with grain on its way to the city of to Italy, and the cargo eventually to Rome. We're told that this ship had a complement of 276 people, plus a large cargo of wheat. So it must have been quite a sizable vessel. Some commentators suggest round about 500 tons at least, which for those days was a ship of good size. However, due to delays, the weather was very much against them, and progress along the coast was very slow. And it soon became apparent that they would be forced by the winds to head south and to pass under the lee of the island of Crete. They'd been wanting to go straight, but the winds didn't permit this. Yes, in fact, this is Paul's journey here on the map. Yeah. So they pass south under the lee of the island of Crete. Paul at this point warns of disaster and urges them to stay in harbour at the island, but the centurion, who is advised by the ship owner and the pilot, and by the way, the centurion would have commandeered this ship and would have become the commanding officer of the whole ship. He had that Roman authority from the imperial government. The centurion decided to press along the coast of Crete to the southwest tip of the island, Paul wanted them to stay at Fair Haven, as you remember, he said, would be safer to stay here. The centurion wanted to winter somewhere along here, but when they reach this point, they find that there's a strong northeasterly wind blowing, which blows them right out into the open sea. And they have a very difficult time. The timbers of the ship begin to spring under the pressure. There was only one mast in these ships, and I don't know much about seamanship, but apparently if there is only one main mast, the pressure of the wind on the mast is correspondingly greater, and there's a danger of the ship timbers springing open. When the ship's timbers began to open, you had the ship loaded with a cargo of wheat. Well, you know what happens when water gets into wheat. The cargo became progressively waterlogged day after day, and the ship would be lower and lower in the water. And of course this, I mean, was extremely worrying for the captain of the ship, because he knew that this couldn't continue. The ship would eventually sink. Worse, the weather changed so that the sun and the stars were hidden. And that meant in ancient times that navigation was impossible. They did all their navigation. It was all by sun and stars. And when the weather was overcast, they had no way of fixing a course. So the cargo was becoming increasingly waterlogged. The timbers of the ship were opening, and they didn't know where they were or where they were going. They were driven across the Adriatic for 14 days. Very, very anxious days. Until they eventually ran aground on what proved later to be the island of Malta. Actually, if you look at the map, it's a remarkable providence of God that they hit Malta. I mean, you could easily miss it. you know, they weren't steering, they didn't know where they were going. They were just going, as it were, at random. I suppose the next thing would be the Straits of Gibraltar. So it was in God's providence that they made a landfall here at this point. Otherwise they'd have been driven away on past Italy. And I mean, I think they would have been driven to death. It's clear from the narrative the ship couldn't have lasted many more days. Come to land in Malta. They're received kindly by the local inhabitants. Paul performs a miracle, and they stay there for 3 months until the worst of the winter weather is over. They then leave Malta, touch briefly at the coast of Syracuse in Sicily, and land on the coast of Italy in the early spring, Puteoli. They then travel on up towards Rome, and Paul is met by several delegations of Christians a few miles outside of Rome, the Forum of Appius and the Three Taverns. He finds this a very encouraging experience. Now, the narrative is superb, it is exciting, it is thrilling, but why is it given? One commentator rather fatuously says, in Acts 27 and 28, we have the most valuable document in existence concerning the seamanship of ancient times. Well, that's true, but I don't think that's why. I don't think that's why it's in the Bible. I think 2 points. One that I touched on in the previous lecture. He's aiming to show us the inevitability of Paul's arrival at Rome. In spite of all the dangers, in spite of the apparent perils which surround them, verses 23 and 24 of chapter 27. There stood by me this night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve, saying, fear not, Paul, thou must stand before Caesar. So there's the inevitability of Paul's arrival, God's blessing on the gospel throughout the world. I think another point that emerges in the narrative is Paul's personality. His sheer moral and personal force and ascendancy. And this shows us something of Paul that in his humility he conceals in his epistles. It's quite notable that he exercises such an influence on the centurion that Julius treats him
with a quite extraordinary degree of kindness and courtesy. Chapter 27, verse 3, Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and refresh himself. That's at the town of Sidon. Paul is able to share in Christian fellowship with believers there. Chapter 27, verse 43, the soldiers want to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, desiring to save Paul, stayed them from their purpose. He has got a concern about the safety of this man. We find it again in chapter 28, verse 14. They come to Puteoli, where we found brethren, and were entreated to tarry with them 7 days. Julius seems to have allowed them to have granted this request and have permitted them to stay 7 days. So there's this influence of Paul on the centurion, and not only on the centurion, but on the whole group of people. He begins the voyage as a prisoner. But as James Stalker says, before it was ended, Paul was virtually both the captain of the ship and the general of the soldiers, and all on board owed to him their lives. So it just shows you the native force of the man and his leadership qualities. You see it, for example, in chapter 27, verses 21 to 26. You remember that passage where Paul stands forth and been without food for days, and he says, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me. I exhort you to be of good cheer. You must do what I say." And they all obey him. Again, in verses 31 to 36. "Except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved." And Paul besought them to take food, and so on and so forth. So Paul is in control. And I think this is an added richness to the picture of Paul. I mean, this is no wimp. This is no sort of quivering little mouse of a man. He's somebody subdued by the grace of God, but a natural-born leader. A man of great moral and personal force. How many prisoners in similar situations would have ended up with Paul's ascendancy over the whole group? And we have the impression that when he reaches Rome, he's the leader of the group. That brings us to the second section of our study, Paul's first Roman imprisonment. At last he has come to Rome, the city he has longed to visit for many years. The greatest city he has ever seen. Over 2 million inhabitants at this date. Over 1 million free citizens and 1 million slaves. So the population was more or less divided 50-50 between slaves and free men. He probably hadn't imagined that he would come to Rome in chains. And yet, his purpose, formed years earlier, was unaltered. "As much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you also that are in Rome." Romans 1:15. Paul spends 2 years in captivity, not a burdensome captivity, a form of house arrest. He has his own private house. He is able to meet people. He's able to talk with people. There seems to be more or less uninterrupted access. Acts 28, 30 and 31. He abode 2 whole years in his own hired dwelling and received all that went in unto him. The only restraint upon him was that a soldier was continually chained to him. He was able to talk, to write and to preach. And yet, it must have been a trying and irksome experience to a man of Paul's active temperament. How he must have wished to travel, to visit, to establish new congregations. But what he did was to convert this house into a centre of far-reaching and worldwide activity. One writer strikingly says, "On the few square feet of space allowed him, he created a fulcrum with which he moved the world." So he moves the world from what? One room. I note 3 things which happened during this imprisonment. Lives were changed. Think of the experience of the various soldiers chained to the apostle for hours and hours and hours every day. And I mean, we can imagine Paul saying, "Oh boy, oh boy, I can hardly wait to get at them." Talk about a captive audience. He is a captive audience. Now, would these men have ever in their lives met a prisoner like this? What would they think of his praying? Hour after hour, praying. And I'm not sure, it wasn't common in those days for people to pray silently. Or to read silently. Those are more or less modern developments. People read out loud, and I think in general, we know there are one or two instances, but in general they prayed out loud. So Paul would have prayed aloud. The soldiers would have heard that. What would he talk to them about? Well, we know what he would talk to them about. And he writes to the Philippians, Philippians 1:13, it has become clear throughout the whole Praetorium, the whole palace guard, and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Philippians 4:22, all the saints salute you, especially those who belong to Caesar's household. So it seems that they were converts, and we can certainly believe that for a man such as Paul, God would bless that daily ministry to these rough soldiers with conversion. Not only so, but many a wanderer who had gone into the far country would enter his home and would leave it a different person. People like Onesimus, the runaway slave from Colossae. Philemon 10:11. Onesimus, who became my son while I was in chains. Formerly he was useless to you, but now he has become useful both to you and to me. So Onesimus became Paul's son while he was in chains. And there must be many, many others brought to faith by the preaching and witness of the imprisoned apostle. Secondly, this was a period when believers were reinvigorated. The local Christians were filled with new courage. Philippians 1:14 is the relevant verse. Most of the brethren in the Lord, being confident through my bonds, are more abundantly bold to speak the word of God without fear. So it has a stimulating and reviving effect on the local Christian community. And it's interesting to gather together the data and see how his different associates came and spent time with him. And after they spent time, they were sent out on Christian work. Timothy, Philippians 2, 19 to 23. I'll not spend time to read these references. Epaphroditus, Philippians 2, 25 to 30. Tychicus, Ephesians 6, 21 and 22. Mark, Colossians 4, 10. He cannot come to them, so they come to him, and he stirs them up and he strengthens them and then sends them away. He doesn't want to gather them around him for his own comfort. And they go out from that place. That place becomes, if you like, a sending agency. And these men come in, perhaps downhearted, discouraged, with the edge off their lives. They meet the apostle, they spend time with him, and they go out with new vigor. And we know from Colossians 4:10 following and Philemon 23... that other people who stayed with him were Aristarchus, Justus, Luke, Epaphras, and Demas. You find them in those references. So believers were reinvigorated. Thirdly, and the greatest benefit of all, letters were written. Colossians, Ephesians, Philemon, and Philippians, the prison epistles. The Christian church owes much in its history to prison cells. We think of Bunyan and the Pilgrim's Progress, but never more than here. And again, Stalker makes a perceptive comment. I'm just trying to remember what book. I don't know if it's available here. There's a little T&T Clark. You know that Bible Handbook series? Do you have that available to you? It was published at the end of the last century, and Stalker has a little book on the life of Paul. Very small book, but it's very well worth having. Stalker says Paul was enabled to do far more in enforced inactivity for the welfare of the world and the permanence of his own influence than he could have done by 20 years of wandering missionary work. Perhaps an overstatement, but I think the point is valid. What does the church owe to Colossians and Ephesians, Philippians? And it was this period that he wrote them. And I think the application for us is quite clear. Our circumstances, whatever circumstances we may be in, no matter how apparently unfavourable they are, cannot restrict or quench our influence with zeal and with the blessing of the Spirit. We must never say, here am I stuck in the backwoods in this little miserable hole in a corner. If only I was in a place of influence, what I could do for God. If only I was in a great metropolitan centre, what a mighty ministry I could have. That's the wrong thing to say. Here's Paul closed in one room. And what does he do? People are converted, the saints are strengthened, the whole Christian world is put in his debt. And your study and my study, under God's blessing, your village and my village, can be such a centre of influence. Circumstances don't govern the man, they only reveal the man. And these circumstances reveal Paul for what he is. We come, thirdly, to what I've called his final period of freedom. I have to stress here a note of caution, because in what I'm about to give you, there is obviously a degree of speculation. We simply do not have given to us the fullness of information which would regard us to say certainly what the course of these years is. But the reconstruction I'm about to give you, I believe, goes as far as we can towards accounting for the available data. And it's based, really, on Hendrickson and Lenske. So I think those are fairly good authorities. But keep in mind that some of this, of course, must be speculative. It seems that Paul was acquitted and set free from his first Roman imprisonment. And we would date this some time before the Great Fire of Rome, which took place in July 64. He wouldn't have been set free after that period. They were arresting the Christians after that period, not setting them free. So sometime before July 64, he was set free. He had, in fact, anticipated his release. Philippians 2:24. He'd hoped that he was going to be set free. I trust in the Lord that I myself also shall come shortly. So Paul thought that he was going to be set free. And he had planned to send Timothy to Philippi to gather news of the church there. Philippians 2:19. Now on our reconstruction we suggest that he did this and told Timothy to meet him at Ephesus. Paul himself headed towards Asia Minor via Crete. And he left Titus in Crete, possibly even met him in Crete, but certainly left him in Crete, in charge of the church organization and life. Titus 1:5. And I say there is speculation here. There is no speculation about the facts of the reference. It's simply just they're putting the pieces of the jigsaw together. So even if the jigsaw is slightly wrong, all the facts stand. We suggest then that he passed through Ephesus and visited Philemon in Colossae. Philemon 22. He then returned to Ephesus, where Timothy met him. Now, one possible difficulty with this reconstruction is that in Acts 20, Paul said to the Ephesian elders, I know that you among whom I have gone preaching the gospel will see my face no more. And we have to think about that. And if you feel that that would preclude a visit to Ephesus, obviously we've got to change some of the details of this. I don't think it necessarily precludes that. I don't think he's necessarily speaking there with his full apostolic authority. This is his assessment of the fact. But keep that in mind. Keep a mental question mark there. Leaving Timothy at Ephesus, he journeyed into Macedonia to visit the Philippian Christians, and then travelled to Nicopolis on the west coast of Greece, where he spent the winter. Titus 3:12. There's Nicopolis there. It's believed by most that he wrote 1 Timothy and Titus more or less simultaneously at some stage on this trip when he was in Macedonia and Achaia, possibly before he reached Nicopolis. Remember Titus, Crete, Timothy's in Ephesus. He's writing back to confirm and strengthen. And you remember I besought you when we were at Ephesus. You see, that's... I exhorted thee to tarry at Ephesus when I was going into Macedonia. That suggests to me that he had been in Ephesus. Then he, at any rate, at this period, he wrote 1 Timothy and Titus to strengthen these men to set forth. And I think he must have known that he is coming towards the end of his life and ministry. He's starting to lay down foundations, isn't he? You know, the how thou ought to behave thyself in the house of God, the church of God, the pillar and ground of the truth. He's laying down permanent principles here. There's a persistent tradition that Paul worked in Spain. Romans 15:24. He certainly wanted to visit Spain. 30 years later, Clement of Rome wrote to the Corinthians, quote, that Paul reached the furthest bounds of the West. And if there's any validity to that tradition, such a visit would fit in very well at this point, because it would be easy for him to pass from the west coast of Greece on to Italy and Spain. And there is, as I say, a very strong and persistent tradition that he did visit Spain. So he could easily have spent some time in 64-65 ministering in Spain. We find him at Miletus, 2 Timothy 4:20. Trophimus have I left at Miletus sick. Was he going to Ephesus again? We find him at Troas, 2 Timothy 4:13. Cloak that I left at Troas. Possibly we find him at Corinth, 2 Timothy 4:20. Erastus remained at Corinth, but Trophimus I left at Miletus sick.
Now, if that's fair, that looks as if at some stage then he was heading directly back towards Rome. Miletus, Troas, Corinth, he's heading west.
But as I say, and I leave that with you, that is only a reconstruction. There are other ways in which the data could be put together. We're simply not told, and perhaps we shouldn't spend too much time speculating on something which the Lord hasn't revealed to us. What we do know is that he wasn't sitting in an armchair. John Pollock says, far from enjoying a tranquil old age, venerated, uncontradicted and honoured, Paul had to battle to the last. And he's a great indomitable old warrior. Here he is, for those days, an elderly man in his mid-60s, still travelling, still preaching, still fighting, still struggling, on and on and on. There's no rest for him. He's not saying, I'm going to retire, I've done my bit, let the younger men go on. He's going on and on and on. And that brings us then to his rearrest and death. Assuming that he was released in 63 or 64, the situation has now changed greatly for the worse, as far as the Christians are concerned. The Great Fire of Rome took place in 64, widely believed to have been started by the Emperor Nero, who then deflected the anger of the people by blaming the Christians. The Roman historian Tacitus was a boy of 10 when the great fire broke out. And 50 years later, he wrote as follows regarding the Christians. A vast multitude were not only put to death, but put to death with insult, in that they were either dressed up in the skins of beasts to perish by the worrying of dogs, or else put on crosses to be set on fire, and when daylight failed, to be burnt for use as lights by night. So Nero had certain avenues in Rome, and crosses were put up right down the avenues. Christians were crucified, and when night came, they were covered in pitch and set alight. They were very, very savagely and brutally persecuted. And in fact, as has often happened when the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, the excesses of Nero produced some sympathy for the Christians. This has often happened. Satan overreaches himself. It's a historical fact that the greatest influence in bringing Protestantism to England in the 16th century was Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary. The years of her persecution so disgusted the people that they said, we don't want to belong to a church which burns people. And this happened here. There's a remarkable statement by the philosopher Seneca in one of his writings. You remember, he was the tutor of Nero and the brother of Gallio, the proconsul in Corinth. Seneca writes concerning this period, "In the midst of the flame and the rack, I have seen men not only not groan," that is little, "not only not complain," that is little, "not only not answer back," that too is little, "but I have seen them smile, and smile with a good heart." That was this Roman. Couldn't believe it. In the rack and the flame, smiling. And it caused a profound impression. And perhaps the later growth of the church was stimulated, I think it was certainly stimulated, by this brutal persecution. It's at this time that the survivors took refuge in what we know as the catacombs, a whole warren of caves and burial places under the suburbs of Rome. But a figure as prominent as Paul couldn't escape. He was rearrested somewhere, we don't know where. It might have been Corinth, might have been in Rome itself, we've no idea. A date suggested has been the summer of 66. Again, we don't know. He was facing this time a more serious charge. And he is not imprisoned as previously in an honourable confinement, but he is thrown into a dark underground hole among the most degraded felons. He describes himself in 2 Timothy 2:9 as chained like a criminal. And that's a loaded expression. What he means is he's not under house arrest. He hasn't his own home. He hasn't freedom. He's lying in one of these unspeakable places. And if any of you ever travel in Europe and can see some of these, what they call are bottle dungeons. It's the shape of a bottle. There's a tiny hole, and you're dropped down the hole into the blackness. And then there's just horrible stench and blackness. So Paul is somewhere here in one of these places, chained like a criminal. We don't know what the charge was against him. He was perhaps charged with arson, because the penalty for setting on fire was to be thrown to the lions. He says in 2 Timothy 4:17, "The Lord stood by me and strengthened me, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion." That may not be metaphorical. That may be a literal statement, that he was facing some charge which would involve the very common penalty of being thrown to the lion. But he was acquitted of this charge. 2 Timothy 4:16 and 17. Note the pathos of those words. "At my first defense, no one took my part, but all forsook me. But the Lord stood by me and strengthened me." And look at the note again. "That through me the message might be fully proclaimed, and that all the Gentiles might hear. See, even again, he's still witnessing when he's on trial. But he had a trial on some charge, we don't know what it was. He was acquitted. But he was not released. He is lonely. Chapter 4, verse 9. Give diligence to come shortly unto me. He will not hold back useful workers for the sake of companionship. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Onesiphorus arrives from Ephesus, his old friend, to encourage. Chapter 1, verses 16 to 18. He was not ashamed of my chain. He sought me diligently and found me. And it's at this time that he writes 2 Timothy. And I suppose perhaps it was after his acquittal. There must have been some degree of increased freedom given to him. At least he's able to write or to dictate in his circumstances. 2 Timothy, one of the most moving of his letters, his last will and testament. To Timothy, his beloved son, come to see me, he says. Chapter 4, verses 9 to 13. What is Timothy to bring? He's to bring Mark. He's to bring the old man his cloak. He's feeling the cold in his bones. His nerve ends would all be destroyed. All the floggings and the beatings, stonings, his whole body, a mass of pain. Bring the cloak and bring the scrolls and parchments. John Calvin has a nice statement on verse 13. Bring the books, especially the parchments. Calvin says, it is obvious from this that although the apostle was already preparing for death, he had not given up reading. So he's on his deathbed. He says, could you bring me some books? Where are those, Calvin says, who think that they have progressed so far that they need do no more? And which of them dare compare himself with Paul? Still more does this passage refute the madness of the fanatics who despise books and condemn all reading and boast only of their private inspirations by God. That's Calvin's commentary on it. So he had some of the things to contend with in his day that we have. And he says, here's the great apostle at the end of his life, and he wants the scriptures and whatever other books there are. A difficult time. Judea is boiling up in rebellion. False teachers are creating havoc in the churches. He says in 1:15, everyone in the province of Asia has deserted me. I wonder what lies behind that statement. I mean, that's a statement to reflect on. All that are in Asia turned away from me. Now, that's a different translation. I wonder what tense that is. That's an aorist passive, so maybe that is referring to something in the past. Maybe then some of them have come back. My translation says everyone has deserted me. That's not a good translation. That would assume that they still were in a position of desertion. The Greek doesn't require that at all. But at any rate, there have been great defection in the church, disruption. But you see the great old warrior here. His heart is not broken. His old eyes are steady. His steps are firm. His voice is firm. He's staunch and steadfast to the end. Chapter 1, verse 12. For which cause I suffer these things, yet I am not ashamed. For I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able to guard that which I have committed unto him against that day. Chapter 4, verses 6 to 8. For I am already being offered, and the time of my departure is come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give to me at that day, and not to me only, but also to all them that have loved his appearing. Verse 18 of the same chapter. The Lord will deliver me from every evil work and will save me unto his heavenly kingdom. So he's absolutely, Mr. Standfast to the end. We don't know if Timothy reached him in time. We'd like to think perhaps that he did. Scripture doesn't tell us. Church tradition has it that Paul was condemned by the Senate on a charge of treason against the divine emperor. The tradition also holds that Peter and Paul were in prison together and executed the same day. We've no problem with accepting that Peter was in Rome, but that does seem suspiciously neat. It could be true, but tradition is even more specific. They were executed on the 29th of June, 67 AD. And there is, as you know, a tradition that Peter was crucified upside down. He was a Jew, of course. Paul was a Roman citizen. He would not be crucified. There is a site 3 miles along the Ostian Way outside Rome, which is supposed to be the site where Paul was beheaded. We know that as a citizen, he would be beheaded. That would be the punishment. Executed by a naked executioner with a great heavy two-handled sword. He would probably have been executed at first light. They would have taken him out the night before and kept him overnight in a place of confinement. And as the dawn was breaking, they would bring him out. Paul would wake that day. It would be the day in which he would see Jesus. For so long, he'd thought of it and hoped for it. They would strip him to the waist. He would be tied kneeling to a pillar, and the executioner would lift the sword. I wonder what passed through his mind as he knelt there. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with, and the sword would come down, the glory that shall be revealed. But glorious it was to see how the open region was filled with horses and chariots, with trumpeters and pipers, with singers and players on stringed instruments, to welcome the pilgrim as he went up and followed in at the beautiful gate of the city. Amen.